From Pacifica Network, this is Democracy Now!
The so-called liberation is one failure after another, and the death toll now is 100 Iraqis a day.
It's been one of the bloodiest weekends in Iraq since the occupation began. Children and a journalist are among the dead. We'll go to Baghdad, then speak with a women's rights activist from Iraq who's just come to the United States. And we'll talk to Tariq Ramadan, one of Europe's most influential Islamic thinkers. He was supposed to be teaching at Notre Dame University, but the Department of Homeland Security has just revoked his visa. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Hospital sources in the western Iraqi city of Fallujah say at least 15 people were killed in a joint U.S.-Iraqi attack. According to witnesses, U.S. artillery bombarded several districts in the city before U.S. warplanes opened fire. This follows a weekend in Iraq that saw a sharp escalation of violence and killings. Some estimates put the number of dead at more than 100. Sunday was marked by gun battles, car bombs, and attacks from U.S. helicopter gunships. The Iraqi Health Ministry says the worst fate was suffered in the Iraqi capital, where at least 37 people were killed, and in Tal Afar near the Syrian border, where some 51 people are confirmed dead. As has been the case from the beginning, Iraqi civilians have paid the heaviest price. One of the most terrifying incidents of the weekend came Sunday when a U.S. helicopter opened fire on a crowd milling around an abandoned Bradley armored vehicle. At least 13 people were killed in the attack. Children are among the dead. The U.S. attack also killed a journalist from the Arab TV network Al Arabiya. The network broadcast harrowing footage of its correspondent, Mazen Al-Tamaizi, reporting from the scene where he is hit by shrapnel. He doubles over and his blood splatters on the camera lens as he screams, "I'm a journalist. I'm dying. I'm dying." Tamaizi is a Palestinian who has lived in Iraq for a number of years. He's the sixth Arab journalist to be killed by U.S. troops since the fall of Baghdad last year. More than 30 journalists have been killed since the invasion began. A U.S. military spokesperson said U.S. troops fired on the Bradley, quote, for the safety of the people around it. Another spokesperson said the strike was necessary to prevent looting of the vehicle. Two other journalists, including a Reuters cameraman, were injured in the strike. The Pentagon says six U.S. soldiers were injured when the Bradley vehicle was attacked. In one of the heaviest barrages in Baghdad in recent months, the capital suffered at least seven car bombs, and insurgents fired a dozen mortar bombs or rockets around the so-called Green Zone compound, housing Iraq's interim government and the U.S. embassy. South of Baghdad, three Polish soldiers were killed, three wounded when they were attacked near Hilla. In the western city of Ramadi, U.S. tanks and helicopters fired on a residential district, killing 10 Iraqis, including women and children. The widespread violence comes as U.S. forces began a nationwide offensive the Pentagon has said is aimed at securing the country for January's planned elections. The unelected Iraqi Prime Minister Iyad Alawi told British newspapers over the weekend some of the worst-hit towns may not be able to vote in the elections, but that they would take place without those voters. Meanwhile, the fate of the four aid workers abducted last week in Iraq remains unclear. No video or photos has emerged of the two Italian women and two Iraqis who were taken in broad daylight from their Baghdad office last week. The two Italian women and the Iraqi man work for the Italian aid organization A Bridge to Baghdad. The Iraqi woman works for another Italian aid organization. On Sunday, a second group claimed responsibility for the abduction and threatened to kill the four hostages if Italy doesn't withdraw its 3,500 troops from Iraq. The Italian government has said it will not pull its forces out and will not negotiate, despite pleas from aid organizations and human rights groups for Silvio Berlusconi's government to do so. The group that has taken responsibility calls itself Islamic Jihad Organization in Iraq. A Bridge to Baghdad and dozens of other groups working in Iraq have signed a joint appeal to the kidnappers to release the four hostages, saying they're not enemies of Iraq and are opponents of the occupation. A U.S. court-martial in Baghdad sentenced a soldier to 8 months in jail for maltreating and conspiring to maltreat Iraqi detainees. Specialist Armin Cruz had confessed to forcing three naked prisoners at Abu Ghraib to crawl along a floor before making them simulate sex acts. Cruz was spotted in a photo taken during abuses committed in October. He's the eighth U.S. soldier to be charged over the abuses, but the first from military intelligence. The jail sentence was 4 months short of the maximum term. Cruz is filing an appeal against the sentence. In another court case in Iraq, the man once in charge of organizing the trial of Saddam Hussein was in court himself Saturday, facing two-month-old allegations he was involved in the murder of the director general of Iraq's finance ministry. Reporters were barred from viewing Salem Chalabi's appearance. An hour after he met with a judge, he was released on bond after authorities concluded he did not pull the trigger in the death. The chief investigative judge said Chalabi is still under investigation under suspicion he paid to have the official murdered. He added that the murder case will continue. Chalabi was first charged in the murder in July. At the same time, his uncle, Ahmed Chalabi, the head of the Iraqi National Congress, was charged with dealing in counterfeit Iraqi currency. At the time, both men were out of the country. Chalabi's role in directing Saddam's trial had been controversial primarily because of his uncle's position as head of the INC, which will be among the political parties vying for power in any upcoming Iraqi elections. Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld mixed up al-Qaeda leader Osama bin Laden and former Iraqi President Saddam Hussein twice in a speech on Friday about the so-called war on terror. In a speech to the National Press Club on the eve of the third anniversary of the September 11th attacks, Rumsfeld began by saying the world just before the attacks was not as serene as some people now suggest. He said, quote, "The leader of the opposition Northern Alliance, Massoud, lay dead, his murder ordered by Saddam Hussein, by Osama bin Laden, Taliban's co-conspirator." He was referring to Ahmad Shah Massoud, who was in opposition to the ruling Taliban in Afghanistan and was killed by al-Qaeda 2 days before the September 11th attacks. Later, in responding to a question, Rumsfeld again confused Saddam and bin Laden in a discourse about how U.S. and coalition actions had made it more difficult for terrorists to operate. He said, quote, "Saddam Hussein, if he's alive, is spending a whale of a lot of time trying not to get caught, and we've not seen him on a video since 2001. Rumsfeld continued, quote, "Now he's got to be busy. Why is he busy? It's because of the pressure that's being put on him," he added. The moderator later asked Rumsfeld if he had meant bin Laden, and the defense secretary replied, "I did. I meant we haven't seen Osama bin Laden." Meanwhile, this news from another country under U.S. occupation. The Pentagon said today U.S. forces killed 22 suspected Taliban and al-Qaeda militants in a gun battle in southern Afghanistan. This comes as Afghanistan was rocked by violence this weekend. Hundreds of demonstrators in the western city of Herat ransacked and burned at least four UN office compounds after the central government removed the governor, Ismail Khan. At least seven people were killed, at least 60 wounded. Local doctors said many of the injured were civilian demonstrators suffering from gunshot wounds. Two National Army soldiers and some 15 U.S. soldiers were reported to have been wounded. The violence was a major blow to the central government, which has sent 1,000 soldiers and hundreds of national police to secure the area for the arrival of the new governor from Kabul. According to the BBC, about 50 UN staff and aid workers are preparing to leave the city. Throughout the weekend, there were memorial services in New York and across the globe commemorating the anniversary of September 11th. A number of groups across the country also had vigils calling for an end to the occupation of Iraq. Meanwhile, a new U.S. government study shows that the environmental devastation in New York may result in more deaths than the attacks themselves. An official government report released on Friday says up to 400,000 New Yorkers breathed in the most toxic polluting cloud ever recorded after the Twin Towers were brought down. September 11, 2001, but no proper effort has been made to follow up on how their health has been affected. The report says the Bush administration suppressed evidence of increasing danger and officially announced the air around the felled buildings was safe to breathe. Another report reveals it has since failed at least a dozen times to correct its assurances, even when it became clear people were becoming sick. The 10-year federal ban on assault weapons expires today. That means firearms like AK-47s, Uzis, and Tech-9s can now be legally purchased. The 1994 ban, signed by President Clinton, outlawed 19 types of military assault weapons, a clause directed that the ban expire unless Congress specifically reauthorized it, which it did not. Democratic presidential candidate John Kerry blasted President Bush today, saying, quote, he chose his powerful friends in the gun lobby over the police officers and the families he promised to protect. Republican leaders in Congress said last week they have no plans to renew the 1994 ban on 19 types of military-style assault weapons, even as some law enforcement officials encourage them to keep the prohibition alive. A Bush-Cheney campaign spokesperson said John Kerry has spent his 20-year Senate career fighting against Second Amendment rights. And U.S. Airways, the nation's seventh-largest airline, filed for bankruptcy protection Sunday for the second time in 2 years. The company's president vowed to continue restructuring the airline into a low-cost carrier during the bankruptcy process. The Chapter 11 filing in U.S. bankruptcy court in Virginia came after U.S. Airways was unable to obtain $800 million in annual cost cuts from its workers' unions that the airline said it needed to stay afloat. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. war, peace, and the presidency. Today, we look at what is happening in Iraq. As many as 110 people killed on Sunday, over 200 wounded, in one of the bloodiest weekends in the occupation since it began. The Iraqi Health Ministry told Reuters the worst casualties were in Baghdad, with 37 killed, and Tal Afar near the Syrian border, 51 people died. Speaking on NBC, Secretary of State Colin Powell said, quote, "This is not the time to get weak in the knees or faint about it, but to drive on and finish the work we started." Meanwhile, in an interview with British newspapers, Iraq's interim Prime Minister Iyad Alawi has said elections must go ahead as planned in January, even if violence stops some Iraqis from voting. In the latest news from Baghdad, at least 15 people were killed in a joint U.S.-Iraqi attack on positions in Fallujah. Witnesses said U.S. artillery bombarded several districts before circling warplanes opened fire. We turn now to Patrick Coburn of the Independent newspaper. He's in Baghdad. Welcome to Democracy Now, Patrick. Patrick, welcome to Democracy Now.
Hello. Can you hear me?
We can hear you a bit. If you could speak right into the phone. Can you tell us what's happened this weekend?
Well, as you said, this has been a very bloody weekend. And it's with people being killed all over Iraq and right in the center of Baghdad. And yesterday in Haifa Street, which is only a few hundred yards from the so-called Green Zone, which is the headquarters of the American and interim Iraqi government headquarters, was 13 people were killed, including a television Arab television correspondent actually killed on air when a two U.S. helicopters fired rockets into a crowd. There's an air of violence throughout the whole city, indeed throughout the whole country. It's very clear this is much greater than it was in Fallujah.
Patrick, can you describe in more detail what happened with the crowd that was gathered around the Bradley vehicle, the U.S. soldiers already evacuated from it? Why did the U.S. attack by helicopter, and what exactly happened with the people, including the Al Arabiya journalist?
I think that this has been misreported somewhat, going by people I've talked to who were wounded in the attack and who come from the area. What happened seems to have happened was this. This is a very tough area, Sunni Muslim, very much against the occupation. Around 6:58 in the morning, a U.S. Bradley fighting vehicle was hit by a bomb, and six U.S. soldiers were wounded, not very badly.
Patrick, are you there? Patrick? Yes, I can now hear you. If you're moving, don't move around. It's great we were able to get you, but we have a very bad connection here. Go ahead.
Okay, I'm sorry. It was hit. The Bradley was hit. And then about an hour later, people came out. There were children sort of climbing on top of the Bradley, waving flags. And then it was somewhat after, quite a long time after, the Bradley had been hit by the bomb, that the helicopters attacked. And it was pretty quiet at the time. You can see that from the video of the television correspondent who was killed, that nothing much was happening. And then suddenly, out of the blue, rockets start raining down.
Hello? Yes, and the Al Arabiya journalist actually being filmed with his report by the Reuters cameraman.
Yeah, I mean, he had been going to work, the Arabiya correspondent, and saw that there was some turmoil and got out of his car. Obviously, he wasn't wearing a flak jacket. And he was just about to begin his report when the rocket landed and struck him in the back and killed him pretty well instantly. But I've thought many of the other people who are in hospital were just people going to work, people who don't even necessarily come from that area, but use that walk down that street in the center of Bagh to get to their work.
Patrick Coburn, the Pentagon, in defense of what it had done, a military spokesperson said U.S. troops fired on the Bradley, quote, for the safety of the people around it.
Well, I mean, that's pretty an amazing thing to say, because what we is not contested by anybody that 13 people are dead and 41 are wounded. Most of them in this attack. It's difficult to see also why firing at the Bradley would make it safe for these people. But in any case, if you look at the video of the Al Arabiya correspondent who was killed, you can see that he's standing about 150 yards from the Bradley, and it was here that the rockets landed. It wasn't actually close. They were aiming for the Bradley. They certainly missed it and fired straight into the crowd. So, I mean, there shouldn't be any doubt about this, because sadly we have a film of the moment that the rockets landed killing all these people.
We're talking to Patrick Coburn. He writes for the Independent newspaper of Britain. Why does the U.S. try to destroy its own vehicles once they've been hit? Even if there's no people in
them. I mean, the reason they put forward is that they wanted to destroy the arms and ammunition on board the vehicle, which had been abandoned in the middle of Haifa Street. But again, this is peculiar to do this from the air, because when this vehicle was hit by a bomb, they removed the wounded, and it would have been quite easy to... if you wanted to destroy the vehicle at that stage safely, to simply put an explosive charge or a grenade inside, which I've seen done in Baghdad before. But it's pretty amazing to wait 1 hour and then attack your own vehicle from the air when there are crowds around it. In this case, you don't even hit the vehicle. You fly your rockets 150 yards away.
Patrick Coburn, what about Tal Afar near the Syrian border?
This is a very strange and mysterious episode, because you have to realize that Tal Afar is a peculiar. It's not inhabited by Arabs. It's inhabited by Kurds. It's inhabited by the Turkmen minority. And it's not a place that you'd expect to be a base for resistance against the U.S. or the Iraqi government. I do know that the government of Turkey, which has a protective role over the Turkmens here, believes that there's really an ethnic war going on there between the Turkmens and the Kurds. It's part of the ethnic complexity of Iraq, and that the U.S. has weighed in on the Kurdish side because it's allied to the Kurds. The idea that this place could be a base for Baathists or anybody else in the resistance looks unlikely, because it's not an Arab town. It's a Turkmen town.
Patrick Coburn, anything else you'd like to ask before we go, is your report from Baghdad on this, one of the bloodiest weekends since the occupation began?
I think that there is a point which should be made, which compared to 6 months ago, that for the U.S. Army, it's a war on two fronts. It used to be, from after the invasion and occupation, that they were fighting the Sunni Muslim guerrillas in the so-called Sunni Triangle in the provinces around Baghdad. It was a war that was substantial, but was still confined to part of the country. This has now changed, and it's a war not only with the Sunni, but with Shiite fighters as well. So it's a war that now ranges up and down Iraq, which is a country about the size of California. So it's much bigger than what we were looking at even a year ago or even 6 months ago.
Patrick Coburn, I want to thank you for being with us of the Independent newspaper, talking to us from Baghdad, Iraq. This is Democracy Now. Thank you. When we come back, we're joined by a women's rights advocate from Iraq who has just come from there, joining us in our studio. And then we'll speak with one of the leading European Islamic thinkers who is coming to teach at University of Notre Dame until the Department of Homeland Security denied his visa. Stay with us. This is Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report, democracynow.org, broadcasting on over 240 radio and TV stations around the country, on Pacifica stations, NPR stations, on public access TV stations, on PBS, as well as on both satellite networks, on Dish Networks, Channel 9415, Free Speech TV, and on DirecTV, Channel 375, Link TV. And if you want to bring us to your community, to any radio or TV station, you can just go to our website at democracynow.org and find out how. 2 to 3 stations a week are picking us up as we broadcast this daily unembedded international independent news hour. We're joined right now by Yanar Mohammed. She is director of the Organization of Women's Freedom, a group that works to stop atrocities against Iraqi women. One of the organization's main projects is the development of a battered women's shelter in Baghdad to protect women who are fleeing from violence and honor killings. Also, the editor-in-chief of the Equality newspaper. Welcome to Democracy Now, Yanar. After this weekend, one of the bloodiest since the occupation began, can you respond?
We came out with our opinion in Baghdad. We had our demonstration on the 4th of this month, and we said we need safe streets for women. And our recognition of why it's unsecure is because the occupation is still there, the U.S. troops, and that is attracting all sorts of terrorism from all over the world. Now, our cities, our neighborhoods have turned into daily battlefields between the U.S. troops and the military resistance. Women cannot leave their homes for work, for studying, for even the streets have turned into unsafe places because of the inhumane practices against women by the rising Islamism. And it's not safe anymore. That's why we demanded for the immediate leaving of the U.S. troops from Iraq as a prerequisite for any change towards peace. And what we see now happening in Iraq are consecutive failures, one after the other, for the U.S. administration. They just cannot make it work. Whatever government they're bringing is totally rejected by the people and all kinds of opposition to it, political opposition and the other kind of opposition that's military. Some of it is local, but some of it is coming from abroad. Because of their holy jihad against the Americans, we are paying the price, and Iraqis are being killed by hundreds every day. We think this needs to stop, and there's no way it can stop if the U.S. troops do not leave. Some people would say, how would you have security if there is no army to protect you? We tell them there is nothing worse than what we are facing now. Hundreds of innocent civilians being killed every day is something something that we don't want to see anymore. U.S. troops have to leave now, immediately, and we will take care of Iraq.
We're talking to Yanar Mohammed, who is a women's rights advocate in Iraq, has just come from there. As you hear the description of what took place this weekend, both in Baghdad as well as in Tal Afar near the Syrian border, your father is from there?
My father is originally from Tal Afar, and I heard the reporters saying that they are Turkmen and that the Turkey will be taking role in this, but this is not the right description. Turkmen in Tal Afar are Shiite, and they are more influenced by Iran, and there is a rising Islamism in that city. And I hear that many of my cousins are being influenced by that rising Islamism, and that's where the I don't want to call it insurgency. We do not like that name in Iraq. Young men want to work to push the American troops out of Iraq, and they are being vulnerable to all the military resistance that is underground. And I hear in Tal Afar, Islamism is able to attract many young men into those underground groups, and that's why all these, let's say, clashes are being done in Tal Afar.
And why don't you like to use the word insurgent?
It is our right to decide. It is the right of people in Iraq to decide our future. And this occupation is refused. It's rejected. It's our right to work against it. And we do not like the words being imposed on us, descriptions being imposed on us. And I do not, myself, do not I do not go for military resistance because they are causing more deaths in the Iraqis than they are in the Americans. But then again, resisting against occupation is a right for every people.
Women in Iraq right now, can you describe the situation more specifically?
It has a couple of aspects. First, from the American administration's point of view, they have brought liberation. That's what they say. But what we have seen is that there's just a makeover. They are pretending that they have brought 25% to the political councils, and they say that we have gained our representation. Those 25% that have reached to the National Assembly do not present women's rights. And most of them are not known activists. Even within the most reactionary groups, we heard that the outspoken women were not chosen into that National Assembly. And, of course, they do not want any representative that wants to achieve equality between men and women or to have a secular situation where women are equal to men. The actual situation on the streets, on the other hand, is being controlled by the Islamic groups. We call them political Islam because they are imposing their religion on the political arena. And the first result to that is that women have to go back to their homes. They go to the schools. They impose the veil on women, and they are having very inhuman practices against women. They are threatening to kill women if they don't wear the Islamic dress, and the young girls in the schools are under the daily threat. If they do not succumb to that way of life, they will be punished. So for us, it's either the American occupation that is willing to do genocide, or the other alternatives, that's political Islam, that will make us live in a completely inhuman and unliberated way of life. The two alternatives do not look good. We think that the progressive forces in Iraq should rise up and do something against this, and we are working for it. We are beginning to make a movement where we are pulling into it civil society institutions to come up with the third alternative, which is the alternative of freedom, of progressive lifestyle, and also the alternative of the working class.
Yanar Mohammed, I want to thank you very much for being with us, director of the Organization of Women's Freedom in Iraq, a group that works to stop human rights abuses against women. Thank you.
Thank you, Amy.
As we turn now to part two of our discussion with an Islamic professor who's been refused entry into the United States, one of Europe's most influential Islamic thinkers, Tariq Ramadan, a Swiss scholar known for his work on Islamic theology and the place of Muslims in the modern world, was appointed to teach Islamic philosophy and ethics at the University of Notre Dame. He received a visa from the State Department, was scheduled to start his classes in late August. But just days before he was set to travel, his visa was revoked without explanation at the behest of the Department of Homeland Security. It turns out Professor Ramadan was barred under a section of the USA Patriot Act, which bars entry to foreigners who have used, quote, a position of prominence to endorse or espouse terrorist activity. Tariq Ramadan joins us on the phone right now from Freiburg University in Switzerland, professor of Islamic studies and philosophy. He's author of the book To Be a European Muslim, has also written Western Muslims and the Future of Islam, described by Time magazine as one of the 100 most likely innovators of the 21st century. We're also joined by Scott Appleby, director of the Joan B. Kroc Institute for International Peace Studies at the University of Notre Dame, which is in South Bend, Indiana. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! For listeners and viewers who didn't get a chance to hear the beginning of our conversation, Professor Ramadan, can you describe what happened? You were first granted a visa and then denied that visa?
Yes, I went first in last March to the American Embassy in Switzerland, and with my file and everything, the petition, and I had to wait for 2 months while there was a clearance procedure. You know, all my files should go again, had to go again to Washington, and then I was called and I received an email in April telling me that, informing me that it was okay. So I went in May and I received the visa, which H-1 visa to which is the, you know, the permission for me to go to the state and to work.
Professor Appleby, director of the Kroc Institute for International Peace Studies at University of Notre Dame, how unusual is this?
In this case, it's quite unusual because of the way in which this was done. As Tariq said, he had been cleared, his petition had been approved, the visa had been approved and issued, and at the last minute it was revoked. I don't know of a precedent for that kind of manipulation. There have been visas denied, and people from various backgrounds and various nationalities under the Patriot Act who have been denied access to the United States without due process. But this seems to me to be a striking case of an intervention at the last minute without explanation.
Has this ever happened at the University of Notre Dame? Have you ever been in this situation before?
We've never been in this situation. There have been people denied entry into the country at Notre Dame as elsewhere, I believe, but nothing of this magnitude, because Tariq is such a well-known person and was known before the initial visa was issued and there were accusations hurled at him, and he had been exonerated and had defended himself, and we still have no substantial evidence of any of the various things that have been said about him. So it's created for Notre Dame a crisis in that we're now faced with trying to answer charges that haven't been leveled in any specific way, and that's impossible. And we're embroiled in, as is Tariq, a back-and-forth media debate, which, in my opinion, is not always the best way to get at the truth, because so many elements in parts of our media are driven by this or that agenda, and so you spend a great deal of time and effort focusing on issues that aren't really at the heart of the matter. So I think Notre Dame is learning a lot from this, and we stand behind Tariq fully and are proud of the appointment and believe and continue to believe it's the proper appointment. And we look forward to a reversal of the decision or some kind of communication more solidly about the rationale behind the decision.
I'm looking at a piece by John Tierman of Alternet, or it was distributed by Alternet, and it says that that they don't think that Professor Ramadan's appointment to a major university would have been challenged if it weren't for the intervention of anti-Muslim groups. Graham Fuller, a Mideast expert who's a senior RAND analyst and former vice chair of the National Intelligence Council, told the Chicago Tribune, quote, pro-Likud organizations want to block people who can speak articulately and present the Muslim dilemma in a way that might be understandable and sympathetic to Americans in talking about the Arab-Israeli crisis. He said they succeed by presenting this as a security matter. There is no way Homeland Security would initiate this on its own. Your response?
Just speaking to me.
Yes, and then I'd like to get Professor Ramadan's response.
Sure. I'm just trying to rely on the facts, and my position in this is to say, okay, we heard so many things about, me and some other Muslim scholars. So I got the visa, and this meant that nothing was in my file, and that I have been exonerated, as Scott said. Now, I knew before that some voices in Europe and even in the States were saying that be careful with this, scholar, this Muslim scholar, we don't know about him, and many were not happy with my coming. So that some pressures came or occurred before. This is, I knew that, and everyone knew that. The question now is really this one. We are dealing here with academic freedom. I have a voice which is a strong voice, but once again, I am against all kind of terrorism. I am against all kind of violence. I am trying to build bridges between Muslims and the Islamic world and the West, and to try to promote this living together we need. So if now it's possible at the highest level to take such a decision under some pressure, I think that really for all the citizens in America, it's really a very important question. Is this the way we are trying to deal with the Islamic world? And if we have a kind of pressure, we can just ban someone? I think that it's the heart of the question. The point is that so far we have no explanation coming from the U.S. administration. So all this kind of, hypothesis and people speaking about this, it's done, it's here, but I don't have the final word why this visa has been revoked.
We're speaking with Professor Tariq Ramadan, a professor of Islamic studies, as well as Scott Appleby, director of the University of Notre Dame's Kroc Institute for International Peace Studies, where Professor Ramadan was scheduled to begin teaching in August. That's this past August. We'll be back with them in just a minute.
Thank you.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Professor Tariq Ramadan is our guest, professor of Islamic studies and philosophy, supposed to be teaching at University of Notre Dame, but the Department of Homeland Security has revoked his visa. Scott Appleby, also with us from the University of Notre Dame, South Bend, Indiana, director of the Joan B. Kroc Institute for International Peace Studies, where Professor Ramadan was expected to teach. I asked Professor Ramadan the question. Let me put it to you, Scott Appleby, the issue of it not being that this being a political decision about Professor Ramadan's views on the Arab-Israeli peace process and not wanting that kind of discussion here.
Well, I should say that we don't know what the steps were to take this intervention to deny Tariq his visa. And it would be foolish for us to speculate that this or that group, or to say that this or that group intervened, because we simply don't know. What we do know is what Tariq said, that various groups and individuals have spoken out both in Europe and in the United States against Tariq and have hurled all kinds of charges that are really shameful because they've been disproven, they're being repeated. There is, I spoke to one reporter who said, I've talked to various people who are opposed to Tariq Ramadan, and they just are viscerally opposed. But when you ask them what specifically about him, what has he done or said, they don't really have a good specific answer. But Tariq represents for them, unfortunately, what they fear, their anxieties. That is, there's a fear that Islam is not to be trusted, and articulate spokespersons for Islam who are also not willing to abandon elements of the Islamic identity that would be a challenge to the West, and who are willing to criticize U.S. and European policy where social justice demands compels them to criticize, and who don't back down from controversy. Well, this can be perceived by people who have real anxieties, real fears, as a vanguard of some kind of subversion that links up in their minds with historic and categorical fears. And so, as a result, someone who's as prominent and articulate and focused as Tariq Ramadan becomes the focus of a lot of unfocused anxiety and charges. So what group or individuals are specifically are behind this, we don't know. We wouldn't care to speculate. But it's hard to imagine, as Fuller said, that Homeland Security was not pressured in some way, the way this was done, the way it was set up, to try to embarrass Tariq Ramadan and to try to make a larger political point about his appointment that really goes beyond anything specifically about him.
One of the issues that you have addressed, Professor Ramadan, the critics are led by Daniel Pipes, is that you said that there were questions about Osama bin Laden being behind the September 11th attacks. And you go point by point addressing Daniel Pipes' criticisms. What is your response to that?
You know, I responded to all these, and these are very old, you know, allegations I heard before in Europe. And as to this, what I said, you know, I made different statements just before September 11th, the same day and the day after. So when I was speaking to Muslims saying that maybe we don't know, because we were still, you know, in the U.S., there were still discussions about who did it. But my point from the very beginning was clear, and even the 2 weeks later when I came to New York, invited by the New York Times magazine, and I had discussions there, I was saying that, and straight after the event, I said, we don't know maybe who is behind, but us as Muslims, we have to say that we know that some Muslims can say and are saying that you can kill an American, a Jew, a Christian only because he or she is American Jew, as a Jew or Christian, and this is not acceptable, and we have to condemn this. So we have to condemn the terrorist attack in New York, and we have to say that as to us, as Muslims, this is not acceptable. And then with time, when it becomes clear that we had more information, my position was clear without any kind of, you know, trying to say that maybe it's not Muslims and that we have not to accept, to condemn. My condemnation was clear, and I told the Muslim, don't go away from that. This is your responsibility that to say, as Muslims, that some Muslims are betraying the Islamic message.
Final comment, Professor Ramadan, as you, at this point, what are you doing? Awaiting word again? How are you teaching now in Switzerland?
No, I am not teaching because I left everything here. You know, everything is in the States, and I am still hoping that this decision is going to be reconsidered. I'm very happy with the stand of the University of Notre Dame, with Scott and all the people around. Very supportive, and in the States, to tell you the truth, so many organizations, Muslim and non-Muslim organizations, speaking out and saying that this is a serious matter and that we have to try to find a solution. I'm waiting for this solution. My only hope now is to very soon to be at Notre Dame University with my home family at South Bend, and to try to start this new life we wanted to start. So this is the hope. We are still trying to find a way to be in touch with the administration, to have an answer, and I'm so sure that there is nothing in my file, that this solution, this mistake, is going to be reconsidered and the solution found.
Professor Ramadan, I want to thank you for being with us, Professor of Islamic Studies and Philosophy at Freiburg University in Switzerland, now appointed Luce Professor at University of Notre Dame in South Bend, Indiana. We will continue to follow your case. Also, Scott Appleby, Director of the Joan B. Kroc Institute of Peace Studies at the University of Notre Dame in South Bend. Thanks for being with us. And you are listening to and watching Democracy Now! As we turn now to our last segment, the U.S. military has announced it killed 22 suspected Taliban and al-Qaeda militants in a gun battle in southern Afghanistan on Sunday. The BBC reports U.S. troops and helicopters fought the insurgents in the Shinkai district of Zabul province, which is widely regarded as a Taliban stronghold. About 40 militants armed with AK-47s and rocket-propelled grenades had attacked American troops on patrol, a U.S. military spokesperson said. Meanwhile, in the west of Afghanistan, about 50 U.N. staff and aid workers are preparing to leave the city of Herat following clashes between U.S. troops and angry demonstrators Sunday. At least 7 people were killed, up to 50 injured, when U.S.-backed Afghan President Hamid Karzai fired the powerful governor of Herat, Ismail Khan. Protests against Khan's removal turned violent when supporters torched buildings in a UN compound in Herat. Khan is a veteran Mujahideen leader, a critic of the U.S.-backed government and Washington's policies in Afghanistan. Karzai followed Khan and appointed a replacement as part of his campaign pledge to rein in warlords. Reuters is reporting the city of Herat accounts for 8% of the more than 10 million Afghans who've registered to vote in Afghanistan's presidential election, which pits Karzai against 17 challengers. We're joined now by Malayali Joya, an elected representative of the December 2003 Loya Jirga, or Grand Council, which is a convention in Kabul to create Afghanistan's new constitution. At the convention, she spoke out against the council chair's proposal to appoint high clergy members and fundamentalist leaders to guide planning groups. Our guest, Malayali Joya, objected tweeted, saying several of those religious leaders were war criminals who should be on trial, not hailed as national heroes to influence the new government. As a result of her speaking out, she received numerous death threats, including from Ismail Khan, the governor of Herat, who has just been removed. She continued at the Loya Jirga under UN protection. Since then, she has continued to press her case against the former rulers of Afghanistan. We welcome you to Democracy Now.
And thanks you a lot also that you gave me opportunity to have some speech with you.
Thank you very much. We're also joined by Amina Massoud, who will help with any English translation if Malayali Joya needs it. Can you respond to what happened in Herat, to the removal of Ismail Khan?
Could you translate?
Ismail Khan برآمد و از کار خود از دست داد.
It was a good news that I heard about Ismail Khan, that he fell from power. He was one of the famous criminals of Western of Afghanistan. He is against women's rights, human rights, against democracy, and always he didn't obey from Mr. Karzai's order. It was the result that he was a criminal person. So the government of Afghanistan decided to replace him from the power.
Can you describe, in your own words, the day you stood up at the Loya Jirga?
Yeah.
And what you said?
I said in the Loya Jirga that I said to my people that why you allowed to the criminals that to take attend in this famous Loya Jirga, because we want to make our we want to. We want to make our country. I want to translate. ما تر از نو کشور خدا می سازیم.
She says that she argued that why we have all these people with criminal past as our leaders and as our in our elections, people who had negative and violent backgrounds.
I wanted to say that why criminals, people, they are taking attend in this Loya Jirga, because we want to make our country.
We want to have a new beginning with new people, not people but terrorists and violent backgrounds.
Well, I want to thank you very much. We have to wrap up the show, I'm sorry to say. But I want to thank you for joining us. Malayali Joya, elected representative of the Loya Jirga, that it was set up to create Afghanistan's new constitution. And that does it for today's program, Democracy Now!, produced by Shroof Abdul Qudus, Jeremy Scaho, Mike Burke, Anna Nagara, Elizabeth Press, John Hamilton, Mike DeFilippo, our engineer. Our website is democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.